Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2009 and Ruination, the early years.
So picture this. It's early January 2009. Huh. The temperature in Charleston, South Carolina has plummeted into the 20s, which is, you know, a bizarrely freezing cold front for them.
Oh, definitely.
And yet, there's this guy sitting in front of a microphone, completely pantsless, stubbornly refusing to let the bitter weather alter his daily broadcasting ritual. I'm King.
And I'm Gail.
Welcome to Ruination, the early years.
We're so glad you're here.
Yeah, exactly. Our mission today is to really unpack the archives of the Big Fatty online podcast. So we're looking specifically at the life, the stories, and just the absolute unvarnished chaos of January 2009.
And, I mean, the way this month kicks off paints such a vivid picture of who we are dealing with.
Right.
Because you have this freezing nipply weather, as he calls it.
Nipply, yeah.
And he just flat out refuses to put clothes on while recording.
Which is just wild to me.
It really is. But that image alone establishes a core theme for the whole month, which is this intense desire to control his immediate environment.
Oh, totally.
Like, he sets the terms of his physical space, regardless of what the external world or, you know, the actual thermometer dictates.
Yeah, and let's look at how he applies that exact same need for control to New Year's Eve, because he completely flips the script on what society expects.
He really does.
We're constantly told that New Year's Eve is supposed to be this glamorous high-stakes event. You're supposed to be in a crowded room wearing sequins waiting for Ryan Seacrest to drop the ball.
Right, the whole modern spectacle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But he tells his audience that his thrilling evening consisted of falling asleep by 11:40 p.m.
Oh, I love that.
Missing the countdown entirely and waking up literally drooling on his pillow.
Which, you know, he treats sleeping through midnight not as a failure, but as a victory.
Oh, yeah.
He actually spends time reminiscing about the old school broadcasts, like Guy Lombardo playing for Aristocrats at the Waldorf Astoria, or Ben Grauer freezing in Times Square.
The classics.
Exactly. By rejecting the modern hordes, he's creating a boundary. He's curating nostalgia rather than, like, participating in the modern frenzy.
Well, his real send-off flex for 2008 wasn't a party anyway.
No, not at all.
It was a massive, extreme couponing victory at the grocery store.
Oh my gosh, this part is insane.
Right. He details how he spent exactly $142, but he saved an astonishing $12,248.
Like, to hit a ratio like that, you aren't just casually clipping something from the Sunday paper.
No, you're going to war.
You're fundamentally hacking the grocery store's pricing logic. It requires militant planning.
Oh, yeah. Stacking promotions.
Exactly. Stacking a store's specific buy one, get one free promo with a double coupon day, and then applying manufacturer rebates on top of that.
He's basically turning mundane grocery shopping into a high-stakes strategic game.
And he's winning.
And add to that, his haul from an Atlanta Trader Joe's. He's securing candy cane JoJo's and Gorgonzola crackers specifically because, in his words, it's soup weather.
Soup weather, that's so good.
Right. And I have to push back a little on the traditional idea of luxury here, because if you think about the reality of getting older, we're conditioned to want that glamorous Times Square party, but true luxury is actually falling asleep at 11:15 p.m. after outsmarting a corporate grocery chain out of $1,000 and eating Gorgonzola crackers in bed.
I mean, that sounds like an absolute win.
It really does.
It's the ultimate domestic triumph. And that focus on the comfort of the present is sharply contextualized later in the month when a listener named James sends in these mind-boggling statistics.
Oh, from 1908, right?
Yeah, exactly a century prior to this recording.
Those statistics are wild to hear back to back. Like, the average life expectancy was 47 years.
Wow.
Only 14% of homes had bathtubs. Sugar was 4 cents a pound. Oh. Women were washing their hair once a month using borax or egg yolks.
Which just sounds awful.
And then there's the kicker. Heroin was sold over the counter as a perfect guardian of health.
That supposedly gave buoyancy to the mind.
It's insane.
The heroin detail always shocks people today, but, you know, at the time, pharmaceutical companies like Bayer actively marketed it as a non-addictive cough suppressant.
Wow, non-addictive.
Yeah, and a safer alternative to morphine. The medical understanding was entirely upside down.
Clearly.
But the reason reading these facts works so well on a January 2009 broadcast comes down to the broader cultural climate at the time.
Right, the Great Recession.
Exactly. The United States was deep in it, anxiety was universally high.
So true.
By pulling focus back a century, he forces the listener to realize that despite the crashing economy, at least we have indoor plumbing.
And we aren't washing our hair with egg yolks.
Right. It immediately lowers the temperature of modern anxiety.
Though I'm guessing that gratitude for living in the future probably evaporated pretty quickly once his own body started fighting him.
Oh, absolutely it did.
Because he might be marveling at the conveniences of modern medicine compared to 1908. But in January 2009, his own physical form and that very same modern medicine completely betray him.
Yeah, the biological reality of existing really catches up with him in a series of very public, very uncomfortable ways.
Starting with what I can only describe as an epic dental thriller.
A thriller is right.
So he goes in for what he thinks is just a simple replacement of a filling. But 4 hours later, he's trapped in a sci-fi nightmare.
Yeah.
He describes this dinging Novocaine machine that numbs him without a traditional needle.
Right, and then the dentist uses a device called a Computra.
A Computra, which takes a 3D scan of his bite. He compares the whole process to cutting out a silhouette in Photoshop.
Which is such a 2009 reference, but what he's describing is CAD/CAM dentistry.
Okay, computer-aided design.
Exactly, computer-aided design and manufacturing. Instead of making you bite down on that awful pink goop to make a physical mold, they use an optical wand to take digital impressions.
And then, literally down the hall, a laser machine physically carves a custom porcelain onlay from a solid block of enamel.
It's an incredible piece of medical technology.
It is. But then comes the crushing finale. He walks up to the front desk and is handed a bill for $11,117.
Ouch.
His insurance only covers $175. So he is left paying $942 completely out of pocket.
And that financial blow just completely shatters the illusion of the space age technology.
Totally brings you back to Earth.
Because dental insurance maximums have notoriously remained stagnant since the 1970s. So while the technology advances into the realm of lasers and 3D mapping, the financial infrastructure remains stuck in the past.
Right.
Turning a medical marvel into a sudden financial crisis for the patient.
And it doesn't stop there. We also get the niacin hot flash incident.
Oh no, this part was so rough.
So he takes cholesterol medicine that contains niacin.
Yeah.
He usually takes this at night, specifically paired with an apple snack, to prevent the medication from causing severe flushing.
But one morning.
Yeah, one morning, he either forgets his apple snack or takes the wrong pill entirely. And the result is intense hot flashes and severe flushing while he is sitting at his desk at his day job at the coal mine.
The coal mine, right. And niacin, which is essentially vitamin B3, triggers the release of prostaglandins in the body.
Okay.
That causes the blood vessels near the surface of the skin to rapidly dilate, which creates that intense burning red flush.
So that's why the apple snack works.
Yeah. The reason the apple snack usually works is likely due to the pectin and fiber slowing down gastric emptying. That delays the absorption spike of the vitamin.
Oh, wow.
But without that buffer, his body simply flooded.
And to round out the physical failures, later in the month, that trademark habit of podcasting pantsless and shirtless finally catches up with him.
Who could have predicted that?
Right. The fat cave is suffocatingly hot because of the radiator heat, so he strips down and points a desk fan directly at his bare skin. Naturally, he catches a nasty cold.
Poor guy.
He spends days feeling phlegmy, relying entirely on NyQuil to knock himself out.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the irony here. He literally has a space-age laser-cutting robot custom building a new tooth down the hall, but he himself cannot remember to eat a simple apple slice to stop his own medication from turning him bright red at work.
It's hilarious.
Yeah.
But it really highlights the massive gap between the technology we have access to and our own daily human error.
Oh, completely.
But think about the broadcasting strategy here. Why share the painful $1,000 out-of-pocket expense, the hot flashes, the GI issues he refers to as the girdiness?
Yeah, why put that out there?
Because sharing these intense, expensive, and embarrassing biological moments acts as the ultimate equalizer.
Right. We've all been there.
Exactly. We've all experienced a medical bill that made our stomachs drop. By exposing his physical and financial vulnerability so openly, he strips away the polished artifice that most hosts try to maintain.
And because his body is failing him, you can see him aggressively seeking control in the areas of his life where he still has agency.
Definitely.
He pivots heavily into comfort food, intense vacation planning, and managing a brand new internet critic.
Because when your biology is unpredictable, you assert dominance over your immediate surroundings.
Let's look at the menu he uses to combat the January chill. he makes this incredibly heavy homemade Rotel dip.
Oh my goodness, the dip.
It's ground beef, Rotel tomatoes, hot peppers, and just a massive block of Velveeta cheese all melted together. And he eats it with organic chips, but he complains the chips are too bland. So he actually toasts them in a toaster oven to give them a burnt flavor.
I mean, the caloric density of a meal like that provides an immediate localized dopamine hit.
Absolutely.
When you're fighting off a cold, dealing with dental bills, and facing freezing temperatures, you don't want subtle flavors. You want salt, fat, and heat.
And the listeners are fully enabling this diet, too.
Oh, they are.
A listener named Ramble Redhead sends in a recipe for Busy Day Bacon Muffins.
Sounds healthy.
Right. The ingredient list is just Bisquick, sugar, an egg, milk, and diced bacon. Baked to 400 degrees.
And Big Fatty is thrilled.
Oh, he's so happy. Because it means he can produce bacon muffins in under 20 minutes.
It's an incredibly indulgent, chaotic diet.
Yes, which creates this hilarious contrast with the absolute militant precision he applies to his travel plans.
The travel logistics are really where he reclaims his authority.
He actually embraces the self-appointed title HOT.
The Hitler of travel.
The Hitler of travel, yeah. He is organizing a march cruise on the celebrity solstice with Granny, Miss Porter, and Miss Kitty.
Right.
And he details his logistical wins on the air like a battlefield commander. He secures rooms at the Innletter guest house for exactly $169 a night.
And making sure to note, he had to physically call them to bypass the $200 internet rate.
Which is such a pro move. Then he hunts down an online coupon to secure a Hertz rental car for 2 days. For exactly $88.86.
Oh, precise.
I was thinking about this dynamic. It feels a bit like a pilot white-knuckling the controls of an airplane during severe turbulence.
Okay, yeah.
Like, he might be sitting in the cockpit, sweating through a niacin hot flash, eating a bowl of melted Velveeta cheese. But by God, he is going to land that Hertz rental car discount with absolute precision.
That's a great way to frame it. He exercises ironclad authority where the variables are known, like hotel rates and rental cars.
Right.
And that need to control the narrative extends perfectly to how he handles his critics.
The sudden emergence of the Daily Mic.
Yes. And to really understand the impact of the Daily Mic, you have to look at the podcasting ecosystem of early 2009.
It was so different back then.
Totally. There were no massive corporate platforms or algorithmic feeds pushing content. It was a very insular, community-driven space.
Right.
So a mystery blog appearing out of nowhere, specifically dedicated to reviewing LGBT podcasts, carried an outsized weight in that circle.
And they explicitly targeted him.
They really went for it.
They wrote a review begging him to stop reading his endless stack of 61 physical Christmas cards on the air.
Yeah, they essentially told him they loved the show, but if he read one more card, they were going to puke.
And they also crowned his friend Miss Wes the podcasting whore of the week.
Which is brutal. In any other context, a host might get defensive or issue some sort of angry rebuttal, but he understands the mechanics of audience retention.
He does. He just reads the entire negative review out loud on his show and just laughs at it.
Which is genius. By reading the criticism on air, he completely neutralizes the threat.
Yeah, he takes away their power.
He absorbs their attack and turns it into fresh, entertaining content for his own broadcast. You take away a critic's power the second you show your audience that their words don't intimidate you.
It's an incredibly savvy media maneuver disguised as casual banter.
It really is.
And all of this January chaos, like the extreme couponing algorithms, the laser teeth, the coaster oven chips, the mystery blog critics, it all builds to a historic mid-month milestone.
Yes, it all comes together.
Because this moment perfectly encapsulates the dual nature of his broadcast, where massive cultural events collide head-on with raw, unfiltered personal messiness.
The mid-month stretch is really the emotional peak of the archives.
So on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, which happens to be his 249th episode, Big Fatty broadcast directly from his bed.
The coma chamber.
A location he vividly brands the coma chamber, yeah.
Yeah.
He is, by his own admission, heavily self-overserved on Tanqueray and tonic.
Without lime.
Without lime. Which he complains about. And he's audibly slurring his words, drinking directly into the microphone. And he uses this moment to explicitly challenge every other gay podcaster on the internet to record their own drunkie cast.
He is throwing down a gauntlet of radical transparency.
Yeah, exactly.
He's daring his peers to drop their polished personas and show the audience what they look like when the microphone shouldn't be on.
But the contrast is what makes it legendary, because the very next day, is his 250th episode.
A huge milestone.
And it just so happens to coincide with the historic 2009 presidential inauguration.
A monumental, highly orchestrated day in American history.
Right. And looking at this purely as a pop culture time capsule from 2009, without taking any political stance on the events of that day, it's fascinating how he processes the transition of power.
It really is.
During this 250th episode, he makes a very specific pop culture joke about the outgoing president, George W. Bush.
Oh, the game show reference.
Yeah. He channels the famously stern host of the game show The Weakest Link, Ann Robinson. And he jokes that President Bush is the weakest link, delivering her trademark catchphrase, "You are the weakest link. Goodbye."
Framing a geopolitical shift through the lens of a British quiz show catchphrase is just such a specific, disarming way to process major news.
Totally. And to celebrate his upcoming one-year anniversary, which officially lands on the Super Bowl halftime, he announces a contest.
The 25-word contest.
Yes. He asks his listeners to email him exactly 25 words or less, explaining why they are the BFO's number one fan.
And that 25-word constraint forces the audience to distill their emotional connection down to its absolute essence.
It's brilliant. And the responses just flood in. He reads entries from a guy calling himself Straight Bob in Australia.
Hey, Bob, yeah.
He gets longtime lurkers who have never commented before finally breaking their silence. He even receives poetry.
Wow, poetry.
And I want you to picture the contrast of this specific day. The entire world is watching a pristine, highly choreographed presidential inauguration with high-tech CNN graphics, while Big Fatty is celebrating his 250th show, recovering from a gin-soaked broadcast on a mattress.
Reading 25-word poems from lurkers.
Yes. It is the absolute ultimate counter-programming.
It really is. And it works because he isn't trying to compete with the polish of traditional media.
Not at all.
The drunkie cast and the 250th show encapsulate his entire appeal. He proves to his listeners that consistency, you know, showing up to put out 250 daily recordings, it doesn't require perfection.
Right.
You can be flawed, you can be slurring in the coma chamber, you can be eating bacon muffins in bed, and you can still show up and command a dedicated community.
Which means we have to ask ourselves a question as we wrap up this look at January 2009. After surviving algorithmic extreme couponing, $1,000 robotic tooth, intense niacin hot flashes at the coal mine, and a gin-fueled broadcast from a coma chamber, what does it actually take to be the number one fan of a life this unapologetically messy?
You know, the physical prize package he's giving away almost feels beside the point.
Exactly. Maybe the real prize is the permission this broadcast gives its listeners to embrace their own daily chaos.
Oh, I love that.
To accept that it's okay to wash down your modern anxieties with a bowl of melted Velveeta keys and just laugh at the absolute absurdity of it all.
Totally agree.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Please come back next Saturday for another month of Ruination, the early years.
And remind yourselves to tune in each Sunday for Ruination Repeat, which recaps last week's current BFO episodes.
I'm King.
And I'm Gail.
We will see you next time.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, the early years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.